Welcome to Beyond Black History Month. I'm your host, Fahmy Redwood. I've been thinking a lot about the Juneteenth celebrations that happened during those first few years after slavery ended. Those joyous times, people singing, friends chatting, and parents watching their children play games, hopeful for the future. Then it hit me. What about those moms who didn't have their children because they were ripped away and sold during slavery? Were they celebrating on Juneteenth? The husband who hadn't hugged his wife in years, or the teenager who hadn't seen his mom in so long he can't remember her face? How do you celebrate when the person you most want to be with is somewhere in this world, but who knows where, and there's virtually no resources to find them? This is the story of how Black families never gave up hope they would reconnect, and how ink, paper, and the pulpit put their families back together.
So actually, one quick question, that's helpful information.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
meet Reverend Mark Kelly Tyler. He's the pastor of Mother Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Philadelphia. It's the oldest AME church in the nation.
Mother Bethel has literally witnessed every part of the American experience,
including the hypocrisy. It formed in 1787, not because of theological issues, but racial ones.
Mother Bethel began with a walkout from segregated pews.
Black worshipers were tired of being forced to sit in balconies at white churches.
And they said, "We will not be second-class citizens. We would rather worship on the street than to worship under those conditions."
He says the church spoke to the unique needs of Black believers, and there were plenty of needs after emancipation.
After slavery ended, many Black people wanted to get out of the South because, of course, you never know, the country may change its mind and may bring slavery back. And so people began to flood the North,
often going straight to Black churches for help.
They help you find housing, help you find employment, help you get settled into life in the North,
and help you find family members who were sold during slavery. How do you find a loved one after slavery has ended?
Information wanted by a poor, distressed mother who had two daughters sold, one named Mary and the other named Peggy.
That was an excerpt from a wanted ad in an 1800s New Orleans newspaper. Formerly enslaved people would place these ads in hopes of finding family members who were sold during the domestic slave trade. The next ad was placed in 1881 in the Christian Recorder newspaper, which was published by Mother Bethel AME in Philadelphia, the same church Reverend Tyler shepherds today. But in this ad, a woman named Anne Sloan is looking for her child.
Information wanted of my daughter, Brawry. She is about 34 years old. I left her in Kentucky. I have heard she's in Louisville, Kentucky. Any information of her whereabouts will be thankfully received.
These ads are only a few words long, but they tell powerful stories about the lengths families went through to be reunited.
Excellent. And I'm pronouncing your name Fahmy, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay,
it's
I just wanted
Fahmy.
To make sure.
Dr. Judy Giesberg is a history professor at Villanova University. She's also helping these ads come to light as the director of the Last Seen Project.
They were sold about 20 years ago to Mr. Blount Robertson of Louisiana.
The Last Seen Project is an effort to identify, collect, and make these ads freely available. Dr. Giesberg discovered the ads around 2007 while writing a book about Black Philadelphians and their experiences during the Civil War.
These advertisements, as I recognize them, had a lot of genealogical information in them,
which also makes them helpful to African Americans today who are looking to learn more about their ancestry. Black folks often encounter a brick wall during genealogy searches. That's because prior to 1870, since Black people were seen as property, they weren't counted by name in the census. These ads were a resource then and still today.
For descendants of enslaved people to fill in their family trees.
When Dr. Giesberg found these ads, there's an apartment complex in my neighborhood called Ebbets Field. It used to be a baseball stadium that was home to the Brooklyn Dodgers. Often when I walk past, I wonder what it must have been like to be a Black child in 1947, hoping to catch a glance or hear the play of Jackie Robinson, who's credited with being the first Black man to play on a Major League Baseball team. His first game with the Brooklyn Dodgers was April 11th, 1947, where he rocked the number 42 on his jersey. After him, more and more Black players joined the league. But 75 years later, MLB still has a race problem. At first, the number of Black players increased. In 1981, according to the Society for American Baseball Research, 18.7% of MLB players were African American. Today, that number is closer to 7%. Let's start at the beginning, at the Negro Leagues. The Negro Leagues were where mostly African Americans, but some Afro-Latinos, could play professional baseball, because obviously, major league teams weren't always integrated.
I played for the New York Black Yankees and the Indianapolis Clowns.
87-year-old W. James Cobbin played in the Negro Leagues. He is the epitome of history come alive. Even if it didn't feel like it at the time, the Negro Leagues and its players weren't exactly rolling in dough.
If you knew anything about the Negro League, money is something we never had. And the Negro League, that's one of the problems. We didn't have any money.
He made $165 a month. White Major League players, on the other hand, made between $300 and $2,000 a month. And that didn't even include their food stipend. But Black players dealt with the low pay because they loved the game.
I do know that when our bus pulled into town, we had people like mad watching us get off the bus, want to sign autographs and shake your hands.
The Negro Leagues Baseball Museum began in 1990.
Ray Doswell is the vice president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Kansas City. He says Black folks were playing baseball before emancipation.
Even during the time of slavery, African Americans certainly could see and witness the game, and free Blacks could see and witness the game, and ultimately began to participate in the game themselves.
He says the organization we now know as MLB began to form in the 1880s. The teams were mostly all white, but there were a few Black players, some who passed as white, but not Moses Fleetwood Walker, aka Fleet. While Jackie Robinson was the first Black man to play on a modern-day MLB team, Fleet was the first Black man to play in the major leagues in 1884. You see, there were a few different professional leagues early on, including the one Fleet played in called the American Association. This later became the American League, which is now a part of MLB. Fleet was a catcher for the Toledo Blue Stockings, and he faced a ton of racism. On and off the field. Racial slurs were yelled at him during games, pitchers would ignore his signals, a death threat here and there. You know, typical Gilded Age racism. There was one time he actually had to be benched for a game because the team received a letter saying if he took the field, a mob of 75 men would attack him.
There was never a written rule in most of these leagues that said that Blacks or more equally as important Afro-Latino athletes could not play, but ultimately it was racism and collusion that kept them away.
Fleet was cut after one season. By the time he tried to get back into the major leagues, the unofficial ban against Black players was in effect. This lack of acceptance pushed Black entrepreneurs to create their own thing. However, these initial Black teams didn't have deep pockets, nor did they have some of the traditional league structures we know today, like playing common opponents on a regular basis.
They played against all levels of competition, white, Black, high school, whatever.
Stability was a big issue. But then, some changes. World War I ended, race-related violence against Black folks increased, political movements like the Harlem Renaissance come into play, the Great Migration happens, and Black folks are getting factory jobs. Doswell says this caused a push from Black fans, Black press, and Black players for these Black baseball teams to become more organized.
Now you got folks who have money that can go to baseball games.
Okay, so Black teams have fans, but they don't have home fields.
Now we get more of a stable attempt at creating a league structure.
And in 1920, black team owners met in Kansas City, and Midwestern teams formed the Negro National Leagues, rival black leagues formed elsewhere, like the Eastern Color Line on the East Coast. There were some ebbs and flows, but for the most part, these teams had success. They even had a Negro World Series. But then, World War II. There's a shortage of black sperm donors, and this shortage especially hurts black lesbian and queer couples looking to grow their families. The majority of cryobank customers are lesbian or queer, followed by single mothers by choice and straight cis couples. And while there's a shortage of POC sperm across the board, black sperm tends to be the rarest, between 3 to 5% of what's available at banks. Here's an example one cryobank gave me on just how fast their sperm sells out on its online database. All of the donors were educated, tall, athletic, and attractive. Donor 1, who is white, it took him 3 weeks for his sperm to completely sell out. Donor 2 is half black, a quarter white, and a quarter Puerto Rican. It took him less than an hour to sell out. Donor 3 is black. He sold out in minutes. This shortage pushes people to look for sperm elsewhere, like Facebook. There are tons of online groups connecting sperm donors to recipients. Many of these donors are willing to give their sperm away for free, but then there are those who require what's called natural insemination, as in you can have my sperm through unprotected sex. These options can be dangerous. They can also cause massive legal issues around parental rights and child support, even when there's a contract. We're going to dig into all of that, including why black men aren't donating. But first, meet 29-year-old Matt O'Shea Julian West. She just graduated with her master's and is on her way to becoming a behavioral analyst. She's also a content creator who focuses on the issues black women face.
Did you know that infertility affects black women twice as more likely as married white women?
Have you heard of the model minority myth? It's basically a stereotype that describes all Asians as hardworking, super successful, and high achieving. In honor of May being Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I wanted to talk about that stereotype and how it's been weaponized against African Americans while simultaneously driving a wedge between both communities. Which is pretty ironic considering there is a history of Asian Americans and African Americans working together and supporting each other against racism as early as the 1940s. To understand the model minority myth and how it's been used against black communities, we begin during World War II. On December 7th, 1941, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. The following day, then-President Franklin Delano Roosevelt declared war on Japan.
The unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan, a state of war.
Then in 1942, he questioned the loyalty of Japanese Americans.
The Japanese American community was essentially rounded up and put into internment camps in filthy, squalid desert areas, desolate, cold areas.
That's Joyce Moy. She's the former executive director of the Asian American Asian Research Institute at the City University of New York. She says Japanese Americans had to give up their entire lives and were forced into camps surrounded by barbed wires. But fast forward 20 years, and according to Joyce, the Japanese American community was thriving, and they began getting praised for that. In 1966, accolades in the form of a New York Times article, the headline, Success Story, Japanese American Style.
The author of the article lauded the ability of the Japanese Americans to achieve and to be resilient after they had been imprisoned during the World War.
Sounds innocent, right? Well, no. This essentially became the root of the model minority myth, which became a weaponized form of, why can't you be like them? The article pitted African Americans and Japanese Americans against each other. What the author described was Japanese Americans prevailing while African Americans were not. The author completely ignored all the systemic barriers Black people dealt with, while also painting Japanese people as the perfect marginalized ethnicity. Joyce says that article pushed the idea that Japanese Americans are resilient. They can be ignored, mistreated, and they will still rebound. And that very problematic belief spread to other AAPI communities.
You don't have to worry about Asian Americans. They are high achievers. So there is always this concept that all Asians are good at math, that we're all capable of achieving high grades and doing well.
She says part of the reason the stereotype became attached to other Asian ethnicities is that Asian Americans are often seen as forever foreign.
For example, someone like me, whose family has been in the United States for four generations, has been told over and over again during my lifetime to go back to China. I, in fact, had never stepped foot in China. How could I go back to a country from which I never came? So there is this sense that we are forever foreign, that we're different, that we remain foreign and different, that we are not able to assimilate. As a matter of fact, that was the basis for things like the Chinese Exclusion Act. We were looked at as inferior beings that threatened white society and the Western way of living and the Western values.
And we literally see this idea of forever foreign playing out in real time. A new study just came out showing that distrust in Asian Americans is rising. The study found that 33% of Americans believe Asian Americans are more loyal to their country of origin than the United States. That's up from 20% last year. The water emergency in Jackson, Mississippi is reminiscent of Flint, Michigan. The emergencies were caused by different failures, but the core issue is the same: disinvestment of Black cities. Both cities have similar poverty rates, and again, both cities are Black. By now, you've likely heard how the pumps at Jackson's water treatment facility failed, combined with record rainfall and flooding of the Pearl River, left families without safe water. Water needed to bathe, cook, and especially in the summer heat of the Deep South, cool down. This story means a lot to me because I used to live in both cities. I'm a proud graduate of the HBCU Jackson State University, and I spent 2 years in Flint working as a news anchor. One thing was obvious in both cities. There was an abundance of talent, yet so little resources. I remember one of my first few days in Jackson and not understanding why the downtown wasn't thriving. The architecture was beautiful. It was convenient to JSU and other colleges. There was easy highway access. Business should have been booming. Same with Flint. And it was, in both cities, until white flight gutted the tax base. While much of the country is just now hearing about Jackson's water crisis, it's not new. In fact, according to the nonprofit news organization Mississippi Today, for the past 5 years, officials have told pregnant people and children under five to not drink the tap water. A 2019 report by the Natural Resources Defense Council found that drinking water that often violates safety standards are 40% more likely to happen in towns with higher percentages of people of color. You may be wondering, why is the infrastructure so bad? For starters, some of the pipes are 100 years old. Why can't the city repair them? Well, nearly 25% of Jacksonians live in poverty, raise water rates, and families will struggle to pay. But the bigger issue is the lack of money generated via taxes. White flight took the tax base to the suburbs a long time ago. When segregation was replaced with integration, older cities, ones that were the hub of commerce, were abandoned. Middle class and wealthy white families didn't want their children going to school with Black children, and they certainly didn't want Black folks as neighbors, so they headed to the burbs. So all that revenue that helped a town maintain itself and grow left to nearby areas. That's what happened in Jackson. In 1980, black families made up 47% of the city. Today, Jackson is 82% black. It's literally the blackest city in the country. Now comes politics. Without going into the weeds of infrastructure spending, in most places it's a combination of local, county, state, and federal funding. Jackson is a majority Democrat city, but the state has a Republican governor and legislature. State Republicans have failed to provide the city with funding for repairs. In addition, the state has been trying to take over Jackson's airport. Here's why that matters. According to reporting from Mississippi Today, state leaders asked Jackson's mayor to give them the airport in exchange for infrastructure funding. The needs of people should not be a move in a political chess game. And if you're wondering where the federal dollars are, according to the U.S. Water Alliance, back in 1977, federal money accounted for 63% of funding for water infrastructure. Today, it's less than 10%. So alas, here we are. Water hydrants have dried out, residents are told to close their mouths when they shower, and there's no timeline when it will be fixed. Later in this episode, we will talk to State Representative Ronnie Crudup Jr. He represents parts of Jackson. But first, I want you to meet someone. Her name is Benny Hudson. She's originally from a town near Jackson, but the capital city has been her home for over 3 decades. She says this should not be happening.
I am totally frustrated. I'm totally tired. I am totally fed up, and something got to change.
Benny is one of the more than 150,000 people in Jackson without clean water.
This morning I had some water pressure. I woke up, went to the bathroom, cut the sink on to see was there any water coming out.
A small amount.
But I can't use the water. You can't wash your face in the water.
That's where bottled water comes in.
I have to put the water on my stove so I can heat it from the bottled water. So I can wash my face, brush my teeth, take a bath. I heard on television where they say you could use the water to bathe in, but I'd rather not.
There's a shared experience of having black hair. Many of us sat on the floor for hours, staring at the TV, between a loved one's legs as they braided our hair. Or we spent Sunday afternoons bent over the kitchen sink so someone could wash our hair and straighten it for the week. Black hair can be a political statement, a statement of pride, or just a style. It is, however, a multi-billion dollar industry. A 2021 Nielsen report found African Americans are 2.4 times more likely to buy hair products compared to other shoppers. In what's called the ethnic hair market, African Americans brought in more than 85% of the revenue. But black folks aren't reaping the financial rewards. Between beauty supply stores, distributors, and products, there were few black owners. Juxtapose that to America's first self-made millionaire. She was a black woman, and she made her money off hair. In this episode of Beyond Black History Month, we will explore the legacy of Madam C.J. Walker. We will also dig into why the majority of black beauty supply shops aren't owned by black people. Last, we will meet a new generation of black women, inspired by Madam C.J. Walker and carving out a space for themselves. Madam C.J. Walker went from earning $1.50 a day doing laundry to becoming a millionaire, philanthropist, and civil rights activist.
I'm delighted to see that you are doing what you're doing.
That's Alelia Bundles. She's Madam C.J. Walker's great-great-granddaughter and biographer. Walker was born in December of 1867, just 2 years after the end of the Civil War. She wasn't born into an easy life.
Madam C.J. Walker started life as Sarah Breedlove on the same plantation in Delta, Louisiana, on the Mississippi River, where her parents and older siblings had been enslaved.
Her parents went from slavery to sharecropping. They died when Walker was 7. She moved in with her older sister, but Walker's brother-in-law was so cruel, just to get away from him, she got married at 14. I'm going to tell you a story that is both a drama and a love story. It's the story of Juneteenth. I know, stories about slavery are usually depressing, and if you're like me, they make you angry. But the story I'm going to tell you about Juneteenth highlights a humanity about Black folks often missed in historical narratives. From a husband loving a wife so much, he returned to slavery just to be with her. To defying danger for freedom, and to turning an unwanted swamp into a prosperous city. Join me, Fahmy Redwood, in a very special episode of Beyond Black History Month, The Journey to Juneteenth. We begin in September of 1862, the middle of the Civil War. That's when President Abraham Lincoln issued the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. He said if the Confederacy didn't end the war and rejoin the Union by January, all enslaved people in those states would be freed. Well, the South didn't stop fighting, nor did the enslavers tell Black folks the president gave them freedom. It's not like enslavers wanted to end the free labor that made them rich. In fact, Leon Litwack, the author of the book Been in the Storm So Long, The Aftermath of Slavery, wrote that enslavers believed Texas would be a safe haven for them. He says beginning in 1862, 150,000 enslaved people were brought into Texas from other states as a way of continuing slavery. So, on June 19, 1865, years after slavery was supposed to have ended, Union General Gordon Granger arrived in Galveston, Texas, one of the last vestiges of slavery, and delivered General Order No. 3. He ordered the freedom of at least 250,000 enslaved folks in Texas. This began the celebration of Juneteenth.
Mom and them didn't know where to go, you see, after freedom broke.
That's the voice of a woman who was enslaved on a plantation about 100 miles from Galveston. Her name is Laura Smalley. Miss Smalley was about 10 when her family, and everyone else on the plantation were freed.
You know, and old Marshall didn't tell you, it was free.
He didn't tell you that?
No, he didn't tell. They waited, I think now they said they waited them 6 months out of that, 6 months, and turned them loose on the 19th of June. That's why, you know, you celebrate that day. Colored folks celebrate that day.
Formerly enslaved men and women celebrated not just their freedom, but the freedom of the children yet to be born. A realization that future generations would have lives they could only imagine, but imagine no more. But where do those newly freed people go? How do they start their new lives, and what dangers would they face?
That news spreading from Galveston and moving upward from the coast of Texas.
That's Zion Escobar. She's the executive director of the Houston Freedmen's Town Conservancy. She helps us understand the decisions the newly freed people faced.
That news is traveling far and wide. As people hear the news, they're learning that they now are free. What do they do with that freedom? Where do you go? They were offered the option to stay put.
But as 84-year-old Jacqueline Bostick points out, many of them wanted true freedom, not a taste of it. And she would know. Her great-grandfather was Jack Yates, one of those newly freed men.
They said that the people could only stay on those plantations if they were willing to continue to work, but they would not pay them.
It's a difficult decision. Go into something you've never known, to places you've never been, after you've only known this life. You don't have the skills to read and write. You don't know where you're going to go.
Zion says they wanted a place where they could do all the craftsmanship and all the artisan work they had been forced to do for their enslavers.
Where can we now get paid for that expertise, for that labor? Where can we make a name for ourselves, a living for ourselves and our family? Where can we educate ourselves so that we can actually improve upon the next generation?
The answer was in an area that would now be considered parts of Houston, but it was a dangerous trip. According to historians, a formerly enslaved woman named Susan Merritt described seeing newly freed Black folks hanging from trees. Historians say they were caught trying to cross a Texas river to the freedom they were entitled to.
You've been traveling by foot, trying not to be recaptured. You finally make it to this swampy, malaria-infested place, mostly along the banks of Buffalo Bayou.
There were no places here for them to stay. There were no institutions for them at that time. So they were allowed to stay down on an area near the Buffalo Bayou. They didn't have houses or homes at that time, so they had to deal with whatever the elements were, and they set up tents and things until they were able to, with the help of my great-grandfather, buy property and move further on up into the area.
And then the story of Freedmanstown begins.